You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Rich.
Always that little delay there, Daniel.
Well, I am in another country. Is that why? I don't know.
I don't think that's why. And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And that was deliberate, Lionel. The Lionel of Flanders is back.
I am. I made it. Back. I survived.
Well done, Lionel. I have to say, an excellent series of podcasts for Friends of the Podcast from Flanders, five of them. Really good. Had a great reaction. People have enjoyed them. And I found them thoroughly informative and entertaining.
Why would you stay on a boat, though? Why would you choose to stay on a boat? This is what I didn't understand. This ruined the whole series for me, Napalm. I couldn't get over this. I just kept thinking.
The reason we stayed on a boat was to keep the costs, you know, sensible. It's quite expensive, Flanders. Kortrijk is not a cheap town. The hotels were quite punchy. So, Lionel.
As the person who controls the purse strings in this enterprise, that was quite an expensive boat.
It was, but it was The one problem was I booked one too few nights, and we got slightly stung. Paying a full whack for the last night. Not only did we pay full whack for the last night, but Simon, my travelling companion and our photographer, our very good friend of the podcast, he left his room key in his room on the boat and couldn't sleep in his room and had to sleep in his camper van. So, yeah, we paid full whack for the last night, and Simon didn't even get to sleep in the room on that last night. It was the cheapest available option. It was, it's the hotels there.
And,
are,
you know, yeah, they're expensive at this time of year, aren't they?
Well, they are. I don't know whether you've heard, but there's quite a lot of bike racing going on around that area at the moment. And so quite a lot of people travelling from other countries to watch those bike races. Probably left booking the hotels a little bit too late. But there we are. It was an adventure. Staying on the boat was fun. And added another dimension. It kind of ramped up the stress levels just that little bit extra.
And luckily your series, The Lionel Flanders, was so compelling, Lionel, that lots of new friends signed up. And so I think we can cover your boat, so that's good news. Before we crack on with today's episode, I think we're going to hear from a friend of the podcast, Christian Prudy, later in this episode. We're going to hear from Luke Rowe as well on nutrition and fueling for the Tour of Flanders, which of course is coming up this weekend. Let's have your news roundup, please, Lionel.
Okay, well, let's start in Catalonia. I should declare here that I haven't seen a minute of the Volta a Catalonia, so you're going to have to fill me in. But I do know from the results that Alejandro Valverde rolled back the years. He won three stages and the overall ahead of Alberto Contador. Daryl Impey also won a stage on the day that Chris Froome lost 26 minutes, surprisingly, perhaps. The other name that leapt out was Marc Soler, a Movistar rider, only 23 years of age. He won the Tour de l'Avenir in 2015 and finished on the podium here. So all the stage racers gearing up towards the bigger objectives to come in the season. There was also a bit of beef between the BMC and Movistar teams after the team time trial. Perhaps you can explain what was going on there in part two of the podcast. My focus was all on the cobbled classics, three races in quick succession for the men's world tour, two for the women. Dwars door Vlaanderen was a 1-2 for Quick-Step Floors. Yves Lampaert won ahead of Philippe Gilbert. The Grand Prix E3 Hauwebeke and Gent-Wevelgem were both won by Greg Van Avermaet of BMC. Bit more beef at Gent-Wevelgem with Peter Sagan and Nicky Terpstra. You know, a bit of a case of after you once the Van Avermaet and Jens Kuchelaer break had gone clear. The teams that impressed were Quick-Step, obviously picked up a win. BMC definitely with Van Avermaet, but also Orica. Orica Scott, Luke Durbridge was fourth in Dwars door Vlaanderen and the Grand Prix Hauwebeke, and Kuchelaer was second in Gent-Wevelgem. Equally impressive was Lotte Lepista, who won both the women's Dwars door Vlaanderen and Gent-Wevelgem. The other race, the other mates of Italian stage race, not a bit overshadowed by everything else that's going on, but notable for the fact that there were no Italian stage winners this year. Lilian Calmejan of Direct Energy won overall. The 3 days of Japan has just got underway. That finishes on Thursday, and then it's everything for the Tour of Flanders on Sunday. In news away from the actual racing, the Vuelta a España has announced that the wild cards for this year's race will be Aqua Blue, making them the first Irish pro team to ride a Grand Tour. Manzana Postobon are also in, a team with a lot of young Colombian riders, possibly selected to mark the 30th anniversary of Luis Herrera's overall win there. Cofidis are in, partly because they sponsor the race, I guess. Casio Royal are also in, even though they had a shocker last year. And I suppose the surprise is that Direct Energy don't get in, because Calmejan won a pretty memorable stage there last year. The business with Team Sky and so on continues. Dr. Richard Freeman has given his written evidence to the Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee hearing into doping in sport. The two main revelations from that are that Dr. Freeman has said that the medicine that was couriered from British Cycling HQ to the Dauphiné in 2011 was Flumacil, a decongestant that is not on the banned list. However, he does accept that there are no records to back this up. He also said that he gave triamcinolone, that's the corticosteroid that can only be used in competition with a therapeutic use exemption, to only one athlete during his time with BC and Team Sky. I say during his time, he's still working for BC. So that means that must be Bradley Wiggins. Wiggins kind of broke cover this weekend. He appeared on Sky TV's Soccer AM saying that once the investigation by UK anti-doping has concluded, he will have his say. He said, there's a lot to say and it's going to shock a few people.
The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa.
Tell you what shocked me, Lionel. Bradley Wiggins, talking of football, Bradley Wiggins tweeting about or turning up at Liverpool game a few weeks ago when they were playing Arsenal. Now, Bradley Wiggins grew up in the heart of Arsenal territory, North London, and now suddenly is a Liverpool fan. Disgraceful.
What a turn.
Should be banned. Should be banned from cycling, ski jumping. Should be banned from all kind of sporting activity for that.
Well, his heart is in the northwest of England now, isn't it? That's been his home for a while. He sports a local rugby league team there as well. But yeah, it'll be interesting to keep an eye on that, and we will keep an eye on that, of course. Lots of speculation about, you know, what Bradley Wiggins might eventually say. And I think he probably will surprise people when he eventually says what he has to say. Anyway, let's turn our attention first to the racing. Lionel, don't raise your eyebrow like that, please. It puts me off.
Sounds like you've got a bit of inside information there, Rich. No?
Well, let's just say that if we can connect this story to Richard Freeman's submission to the DCMS committee, a lot of people have been poring over that. One point he does make in there is he stresses the importance of the coach athlete doctor relationship, and that no medical decisions happen without all those three parties knowing about it. Interestingly, when Shane Sutton was in front of the DCMS committee a while ago, he was Bradley Wiggins' coach, remember, in 2011 and 12. He claimed not to have any knowledge of Wiggins' treatment at the time. So Richard Freeman's testimony there contradicts what Shane Sutton said in front of the DCMS committee, and I would suggest that's worth keeping in your minds as we move forward. But shall we?
It's worth raising a conspiratorial eyebrow.
It's certainly worth that. Rich? It's always worth that.
Anyway,
the racing, though, chaps, very interesting. The racing. Gent Wevelgem. Shall we talk about Gent Wevelgem first? It's the most recent race. What a cracker it was, and Greg Van Avermaet won the race. I mean, what a record he's got this year in the Cobbled Classics, winning Het Nieuwsblad, E3 and Gent Wevelgem. He goes into the Tour of Flanders as an obvious favourite, despite this history of a winner of Het Nieuwsblad never winning the Tour of Flanders. So holding your form over that period, Daniel shakes his head dismissively. It doesn't matter. He's flying.
He is absolutely flying, and it's really clicked for him over the last year or so, hasn't it? It was someone who was thought of, considered almost a nearly man, a lot of second places, and really seemed to have a bit of a mental block at times. Was obviously a very strong rider, but couldn't convert the opportunities that he was creating. And we've seen this before, that once riders start winning, they tend to carry on winning and the pressure goes. And even, I think, even on a physiological level, if a guy is less stressed, if he's very relaxed because he knows he's fulfilled his obligations to a team, I can imagine that's worth, you know, 3 or 4 watts or whatever, purely even on a muscular level. And it seems that he's just stronger than ever. But, you know, it got me thinking at the weekend about Van Avermaet and how little really is known and appreciated about him. You know, we know he's a Belgian, he's from the heart of Flanders, he's from Lokeren, between, well, not quite the heart of Flanders, but it's sort of between Ghent and Antwerp. And but he's not really the kind of guy that you consider to be a sort of typical Vlahoot Flandrian. He's not really someone who's renowned for being incredibly,
doesn't,
you know,
even
hard
look Flandrian,
and,
does he?
No, he doesn't really look Flandrian, and he's not the kind of guy, you know, when you picture Greg Van Avermaet on a training ride, he's not someone that you sort of picture going up cobble climbs with a balaclava and 5 layers on in, you know, blizzards and howling gales. He's, you can more easily picture him sort of at a training camp in, on the Costa Brava, or perhaps because he's mainly ridden for, well, he's spent the last few years at BMC. And yeah, not much is known about him, partly also because he's a very... I mean, innocuous maybe sounds slightly offensive, but he's someone who doesn't really have many enemies or any enemies. I mean, you talk to Belgian colleagues about him and they say he is unfailingly polite. He's a really nice guy. Very rarely has courted any kind of controversy. I mean, 2 years ago, wasn't it? It was there was a story about his links with a doctor and allegations of ozone doping, and he was subsequently cleared on that score. But beyond that, and beyond sort of murmurings of disputes and arguments with Philippe Gilbert at BMC, there's not really been a whole lot in the way of controversy. And yeah, I mean, he's someone who's probably been undervalued, underappreciated, but it was unbelievably strong at Gent-Wevelgem in particular. I mean, the way he pulled away, I know Sagan and Terpstra had their little sort of disagreement, and it was a few minutes or so before they actually decided that they were going to properly give chase. But even when they did give chase, and, you know, Nicky Terpstra is one of the best rouleurs in the world, and Peter Sagan's one of the strongest riders in the world, and Van Avermaet, doing most of the work with Coicolera, was pulling away. And this is also, you know, well, all of these races that Ghent, that Van Avermaet has won this spring, they've been races that suit him, in his opinion, less than the Tour of Flanders. Because one thing he continually says is that he likes much longer races. So when you go over 240, 250 kilometres, he comes into his own. He doesn't particularly like the races around 200, 220 kilometres.
The thing about Van Avermaet is the versatility, isn't it? I mean, he won that Tour de France stage in the Massif Central at Le Lyon last year. He won the Olympic road race, you know, and then the Cobble Classics, he's hoovering them up this spring. You know, he's got a good record in some of them in the past, but, you know, he seems to have really stepped on a bit. It's tough to say what kind of races don't suit him. And certainly at Harelbeke, the race on Friday, when he was in the three-man group with Oliver Nason and Philippe Gilbert, when Gilbert made that attack on the Tegenberg, which was the last climb, still with 15 kilometres to go to the finish, Van Avermaet really didn't miss a split second. He was straight, reacted very, very quickly, and looked both strong and responsive. And even with Gent-Wevelgem, he was one of the riders complaining most vocally, or perhaps because of his profile, his comments were amplified the most. But he wasn't a fan of these plug streets, the off-road sections, gravelly sections through the battlefield areas. Said they were a gimmick that was unnecessary for the race, and yet he took command of the race and didn't let that affect him one bit. It was a really impressive couple of days of racing, and the thing is whether he is going to get the sort of, whether he's going to need the freedom on Sunday. I mean, it may well be that when he moves, and if he's strong enough, he's going to pull away a small group of people who just aren't on the same level as him at the Tour of Flanders.
But he's going to have a target on his back, isn't he? And this is the thing that I think, you know, Daniel talking about us all underrating Van Avermaet, and perhaps his rivals have too. You know, he doesn't have an edge to him, I guess. And it seemed almost in that break on Sunday in Gent-Wevelgem that they were, Nicky Terpstra especially, was far too concerned with Peter Sagan and not concerned enough about Greg Van Avermaet. Sagan said afterwards that Terpstra was riding for Sagan to lose as much as for him to win. You know, you can imagine we had a bit of in-car footage during Gent-Wevelgem, and there's some fraught scenes in the Quick-Step car with Tom Steels and Wilfred Peters there. We saw inside the Lotto car as well with Marc Sargeant. Marc Sargeant's normally pretty unflappable, but he looked like they just didn't know what to do. I mean, that moment where Van Avermaet and Coquelaire got a tiny little gap initially, and they both just put their heads down and were fully committed. And even before that, I felt for a while that five-man group had been fully committed, and you know, it was a great combination. But there must have just been a moment there where, on these wide open roads, into a slight headwind, where Terpstra just, you know, began soft tapping, and, you know, Sagan would have been very alert to that. And Sagan played that game where he let a little gap open, thinking Terpstra would close it. Terpstra didn't close it, and they're away. And Van Avermaet and Coquelaire didn't even look round. That was what was so impressive. They just kept their heads down and kept working hard into that headwind. And it's so difficult for a little group like that to get away and stay away into those sorts of conditions.
What's your view on the post-race comments from Sagan, particularly about what the way that Terpstra was riding? I mean, I've seen a bit of criticism of Sagan that, you know, somehow, because he's the world champion, because he's one of the strongest, if not the strongest, in the race, and certainly the strongest in that group, that somehow the onus is on him to do all of the work. And I don't know, what do you reckon?
I think... Terpstra, I mean, he perhaps made a split-second decision, a split-second mistake, but you have to remember that the situation in any given race at any given moment is constantly evolving, and he's making his decisions based on what he thinks is the best chance of his team winning. And there was a certain point when the break... So obviously, when he followed Sagan, that he thought that he was marking that move, and that he was snuffing that move out, and that was the best chance for Quickstep to win, to either prevent Sagan and Van Avermaet going away, or to be with them and not to do too much work, and then to possibly win himself. But there was obviously a certain point where he felt, well, I think it was Trentin was behind, and maybe was it Stibar was behind, or they certainly had a couple of guys in the group behind, and he felt, or he was told, I think, he suggested that at that point the communication or the radio wasn't working, but he decided that the best chance was for the group behind to catch them, and for Quickstep to use their power in numbers.
Quickstep's best chance to win was surely Gaviria. I mean,
that was ultimately that was so. Gaviria, yeah.
It's a difficult situation that Nicky Terpstra was unlikely to win from that group. So what do they do? You know,
again, Rich, it's a case of someone being, if you are to level one criticism at Terpstra, it's that he was too preoccupied with one rider, and that was Peter Sagan. He should have been equally preoccupied with Greg Van Avermaet.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
My name's Luke Rowe, and I ride for Team Sky. So how you fuel for one of the big classics such as Flanders or Roubaix? So it kind of already begins on the Saturday at breakfast. It's quite straightforward. There's nothing too much to it. It's just a case of breakfast, lunch and dinner the day before would be quite carbohydrate based, and a big carbohydrate portion. It's just so you kind of build up that bank of energy, so to speak. You know, obviously mix your proteins in and stuff, what have you, and a bit of edge. Yeah, I think it's just carbs, carbs, carbs. Often you don't eat quite as much as you should in the race. So you've got to kind of make up for that for the 24 hours prior. The typical breakfast, the morning of something like the Tour of Flanders, it would first start off with just a big plate of pasta. There's porridge there as well, but I prefer just you know, plain pasta, a drizzle of olive oil and a bit of cheese. Just kind of fills you up a little bit more, and there's a bit more substance to it. So it might not seem like the most exciting thing to have for breakfast, but yeah, big plate of pasta. For your proteins, you'd have an omelette or some, if the chef's feeling generous, and make some protein pancakes or what have you. And then just a few, you know, bit of bread with jam and stuff like that. So during the course of the race itself, I usually start with 6 to 8 rice cakes, which is, to put it in simple terms, a bowl of rice. So they boil the rice, mush it together and put some flavour in there, whether it's jam or a bit of fruit. And usually I take 6 to 8 of them and a couple of gels, and that'll do me until the feed zone. Well, whenever the feed zone is, usually around halfway, so 120. And then you pick up the feed bag and possibly pick up another 4 or 5 rice cakes or little paninis. You go as far on solids as you can, because, you know, during the start of the race, you'd only be taking gels, what have you. And then moving into the second half of the race, after you've had all the rice cakes and the go bars, you'd switch to gels then for the finale, if you want, for the last couple of hours. We've got the double espresso caffeine gel, so that's like quite a big amount of caffeine, so you have that kind of 60k out, and then just try and take as many gels as you can. The gels are so important in the second half of the race, purely because essentially it's just sugar. It's quick, accessible energy, and some of the gels are caffeinated, so there's that to give you a little bit of a buzz as well. So, but you know, if you take that too early, then you're not going to get the effects of it later on. You know, it's all about having the solids and just building up all them carbs towards the start and trying to keep the tank topped up, and then switching to gels in the second half just for the sugar, and as you're starting to get more and more fatigued and tired, they just you know, cue up the energy. Also, it's easier to consume gels in the second half of the race and towards the end, just because they're just easier to take, and you can, your body can just absorb it a bit better, and it's just a quick process, kind of bite the top of a gel and slam it down. Also, you have the zone hoppers here at the Classics, so pretty much every cobble section at the end you'll see some zone hoppers who are, you know, guys with wheels, bottles, and attached to the bottles will be gels. So obviously you actually haven't got access to solid foods towards the latter end of the race either, so you can exit a cobble section, grab a bottle, rip the gel off it, slam that down, bottle in the cage, bam, off you go. It's just quick and effective, I guess. In terms of the flavours, I'd say my personal favourite is the double espresso caffeine gel. So it's equivalent to a double espresso coffee. But yeah, you obviously can't have too many of them. I'll probably only have one of them during a race, possibly two. But that's my favourite, just because I like my coffee. And, you know, there's a lot of fruity flavours and stuff, but I prefer that double espresso one. In general, I think most guys are pretty happy with all the flavours. I certainly, well, yeah, whatever I get in the feed bag, I'm not fussy, I'll have it. But yeah, double espresso takes the win for me. If we've had a good result and we're back at the hotel after, you know, certainly have a good feast. And also after the race, it's important to have a good feed again, because, you know, your body's completely empty. You've had, you know, normally one hell of a day out on the bike and your body's battered. And it's all about, firstly, recovery. So it's important to get that good evening meal after the race. And yeah, I mean, if it's a good result, or, you know, if we've got a podium, or, you know, dream come true, if someone's won, we yeah, might have one beer or a glass of wine, but you know, just keep a cool head in it after the races, unless it's after Roubaix, then we, you know, we have a bit of a blowout, a bit of a party after Roubaix, just to, you know, celebrate the whole campaign, whether win, lose or draw. It's nice to have that end goal of a bit of a party and a bit of a blowout with all the guys who you've been through thick and thin with over the previous month and the whole Classics campaign. So it's kind of like after Roubaix, it's the one blowout of the year where we get to have a few drinks and have a good party.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Yes, thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport, who sponsor the Cycling Podcast. And we heard there from Luke Rowe of Team Sky telling us some of his insights about fueling for a one-day race. You mentioned Tour Flanders, of course, which is coming up this weekend. On Science and Sport, they continue to offer listeners to the Cycling Podcast a whole 20% off their products. If you go to the checkout at scienceandsport.com and enter the code CPOD20, that's a new code, the old code will no longer work. CPOD20, that's CPOD20, you will get 20% off. So that's a great bargain, and it doesn't work in conjunction with other discounts. So but you know, for full priced products, 20% off, CPOD20. And you, I think you were fueled by Science and Sport on your Lionel Flanders exploits, Lionel.
I was. The day that lunch was delayed due to general incompetence, an energy bar came in very helpful.
I thought that would have been a perfect moment for your cassoulet gel.
No traction on the calls for a cassoulet-flavoured gel. The Science and Sports top people don't seem to be picking up this idea and running with it. So maybe, maybe next year.
Okay, chaps, well, that's enough looking back. Let's look ahead to the Tour of Flanders, the Ronde. Daniel, are you going to give us your star ratings this week, as you did from Milan San Remo, and for which you were brutally, mercilessly...
No.
...criticised in our newsletter?
Yeah, despite the fact that they were absolutely elite... They were absolutely elite, and I practically got the whole of the top 20. But anyway, not necessarily in the right order, but it was
not how I read it. But anyway, well, Daniel, who are your men to watch in Flanders? I mean, obviously Greg Van Avermaet, but what are you thinking?
I'm thinking there are a few guys we haven't seen enough of yet who have maybe got something to prove. I think Trek Segafredo have got a very, very good classics team, and they've looked quite good, but have not really been at the pointy end of any of these classics. So we're talking about Degenkolb, Stuyven, Fabio Fellini has actually surprised and impressed me.
Oh, very riding in a very odd fashion from time to time.
Yeah, riding in a very odd fashion. Lotto Soudal have been poor thus far. Thijs Benoot is the rider who I expect to do probably best of their team. I expect him to have a good Flanders. Alexander Kristoff has been patchy so far at the start of this year. He'll obviously be hoping to hit form in the next week. I see him as having more chance in Paris-Roubaix, the way the season's gone so far for him. And Sky also need to show something. I think...
Well, Sky are missing their two best Tour of Flanders riders, Geraint Thomas and Michał Kwiatkowski.
Yeah, I mean, Kwiatkowski took the decision not to do Flanders this year, not to do those races, but which has left Luke Rowe with a pretty major responsibility. Gianni Moscon is also kind of hedging his bets this year. He's doing a little bit of the cobbled races, but also wants to do well in the Ardennes, or particularly Amstel Gold, but I expected him to come into his own this year. And so they really need to step up, and Luke Rowe is, as I say, he's got a lot of responsibility for Sky. Who's going to win? I think Sagan will probably win. I mean, Napalm mentioned Gent Wevelgem. The winner of Gent Wevelgem never wins the Tour of Flanders. I must have said this before, but it's the cycling equivalent of the US Masters Par 3 competition, isn't it? I know that means nothing to you, Richard, and it's probably upset more of our listeners. And I swore to myself privately that I wasn't going to upset anyone this week, but I've probably just upset some people by mentioning golf again.
You had to ruin it.
Anyway.
Napalm, what are your thoughts?
I think I kind of agree with Daniel there. I think Trek have got a strong team, but they've had a shocker so far. Cannondale have got one rider that you would expect to have been up there in something or another so far. But since Het Nieuwsblad, Sepp van Marck has had woe after woe, struggling with illness still, I think. But that could be just him keeping under the radar. But it's going to the big ones to watch are going to be Sagan, Van Avermaet, Gilbert, and then the likes of Degenkolb and Kristoff will be really dangerous if they're allowed to float into groups towards the end, because they may well have the sprint, Kristoff particularly.
I mean, Sagan got that monkey off his back last year, didn't he, winning his first monument at the Tour of Flanders just through brute strength and the extra distance. He's been so strong in these races so far, they almost haven't been hard enough for him. And I think the extra distance at the Tour of Flanders is 260. It could just be that Sagan is just better than everybody else and he wins it. But he'll have to get rid of Greg Van Avermaet, I think. And, a sprint between the pair of them could be quite interesting because they're both fast. But Van Avermaet is very clinical this year and is obviously riding with great confidence. I want to mention Peter Sagan's Bora adverts. Have you been watching them? He's been doing these fantastic cooking classes for his new sponsor Bora. Really, Only Peter Sagan could carry that off. Nobody else could get away with that. But worth looking up if you haven't seen them. Shall we turn our attention to the Tour of Catalonia, which Lionel's just going to duck out of this one, aren't you?
Yeah, I haven't seen any of it. I'm interested to hear what you guys say about the team time trial beef, but and Chris Froome's the Froome apocalypse, where he lost 26 minutes. But just before we move on to the racing in Spain, Rich should just give another plug for the Friends of the Podcast special, the Lionel of Flanders. Now it's all done. Five episodes telling the story of the three races from last week. But more than that, really, it's about a bit of the history and the culture. Take you to the heart of Flanders. Listen to it in the run-up to the Tour of Flanders this Sunday, or listen to it, you know, when the race just starts and you just mute the TV and listen to us instead.
Basically, listen to any time. I mean, and you can, it's all in one big chunk now, so you can listen to the whole thing as a one-er. It was wonderful. I really, really enjoyed it. Well done, Lionel. Especially the final episode was excellent.
Well, thank you very much, Rich. Right back at you, as they say in radio.
Okay. Thanks.
Because next week, after the Tour of Flanders, once the Tour of Flanders is out of the way, everyone will be turning their attention to Paris-Roubaix. And Richard, you went and interviewed Matt Heyman about how he won the race last year. And I have to say, the level of insight you get from hearing a rider talk in depth about a race as it unfolded, the sort of the moments of doubt, the moments where he thought it was all slipping away, and then managing to pull off victory at the end. Terrific listen. So if you haven't signed up as a Friend of the Podcast yet, you not only get the bumper Flanders episode, but Matt Heyman's Paris-Roubaix as well.
Yeah, he was a very engaging interviewee, and there was the whole build-up to the race as well, which he talked about. Obviously, he fell and broke his elbow at the Het Nieuwsblad, and then spent a lot of time on his home trainer in the run-up to Paris-Roubaix. It's a really interesting story, and yeah, he told it very well. We also hear in that episode from Matt Keenan, the guy who commentated on it for viewers in Australia. So Catalonia, yeah, I mean, you mentioned the team time trial debacle, Lionel. Despite that, despite Movistar being penalised a minute for riders pushing each other, it looked pretty innocuous, although I've seen lots of information on Twitter about how much the riders could have gained from that. Despite that, Alejandro Valverde still ended up the overall winner, and he was incredibly dominant. I would suggest that he's a rider we should keep an eye on.
Yes, Rich, Valverde going from strength to strength, and I'm not sure I want to make this point, chaps. You might have to throw me the rubber ring and salvage me, save me from these shark-infested waters. However, I have seen some conjecture on, debate about, you know, well, specifically talk about doping on social media. And obviously...
Never. Talk about doping on social media. Yes.
And obviously Alejandro Valverde is well known, he's notorious for his involvement in Operación Puerto, the scandal involving the gynecologist Eufemiano Fuentes and blood bags, and which broke in 2006. Valverde didn't get punished until a few years later. However, it got me thinking, this isn't really a point about Valverde. It's a general point. But it really occurred to me that rarely has there been a more uncertain time, I think, in the recent history of professional cycling, in terms of trying to guess or knowing or having any idea what is really happening on a doping front. And the main reason for that is that there have been no positive tests or no major scandals involving big riders for several years now. And, you know, I was thinking back to the point of comparison that a lot of people were presenting was the start of Valverde's career, so 2003, and talking about how he was just as strong as he was in 2003, as 2004, 2005, in certain cases citing his times on certain climbs and so forth and so forth. However, one of the things that made it quite easy in that period to suspect and to have a very good idea what was going on, who might be doping, who wasn't, was the fact that, you know, in a given peloton of 200 riders, you had a very good idea what was happening, because guys, 10 or 15 guys over the course of 6 months or a year were testing positive or were involved in major investigations, in which you eventually found out that these riders, what these riders were taking, when they were taking it, how they were taking it. And consequently, you were able to build a sort of jigsaw puzzle. You were able to assess the real context of what was going on in professional cycling on a doping front. Now, the best we have at the moment, and a lot of people were using this as their sort of yardstick at the weekend, was times on a climb or a rider's past results. And obviously there is something slightly incongruous about the fact that Valverde is just as strong as he seems to be just as strong as he was when he was, when we know that he was doping. However, we really don't know anything about what kind of doping might be going on in the current peloton, because no one is getting caught, and there are no police investigations. So, you know, you can't prove a negative. So we don't know for sure that in a given peloton of 200 riders, those 200 riders are all clean, but we know that they're not failing tests. However, 10 years ago, we knew for a fact that 10 riders out of 200 or 15 riders out of 200, we knew exactly what they were doing. So that made it so much easier to judge the other 185 riders in the peloton. And I personally am not confident. I'm still not confident enough in comparing times from different eras, particularly because I think the margins that the differences, or the kind of buffer zone, is too small. So, you know, you used to have these sort of these theoretical red flags of, you know, people like Antoine Weyer have suggested 400 watts over 20 minutes or so. Anything above that is a red flag. But we had performances in the past, like I think Jan Ulrich in Andorra in 1997 was one, which was 495 watts, which is way above what is supposedly possible, theoretically possible. Now, the kind of figures that people are talking about and mentioning, you know, on social media and so forth, Valverde's performances at the weekend, they are, you know, they're 410, 420. So they're slightly above what people might think is the line of possibility, impossibility. But they're certainly not far enough above that line for me, at least, to be confident about my judgments.
Are you wanting that rubber ring yet, Daniel?
That was quite.
We should toss that into the water.
That was quite a meandering monologue, wasn't it? However,
it's always interesting.
But I think the main point that I wanted to make was that that lack of positive tests and that lack of information. That it's a great resource when some of the best riders in the world test positive. It's a great resource. It's a great point of comparison for their peers. You know, if six guys in the top 10 in the Tour de France have all tested positive for EPO, then you can start to make hypotheses, start to maybe speculate about the other four guys in the top 10. But in the absence of that, it's very, very difficult.
I think nobody's naive enough to suggest that the lack of positive tests or, you know, concrete information means that there's nothing going on. I mean, we know from past experience that would be foolish to think that. I mean, one point maybe worth making, you're wary of making any points because you don't want to read too much into them, but at the Catalunya over the last week, we saw riders like Marc Soler, who you mentioned at the start, David Godu, is that the correct pronunciation? Godu, the 20-year-old on Francis Dujeu, won Tour de l'Avenir last year. Marc Soler, 23, won it a few years ago. I'm going to say, 10 years ago, we didn't see first year pros performing as Godu did last week. I think he was exceptional. Soler obviously was brilliant as well. Of course, I'm going to contradict myself now, because 10 years ago, 15 years ago, Valverde was a really promising young rider. And I remember the excitement around him and Damiano Cunego especially at a certain point in cycling history, 2003 I think it was, when they were the two rising stars, and they were tipped to dominate cycling for the next decade. You know, Valverde is clearly, and you speak to other riders, and we're planning a Valverde special this year, actually. I can let the cat out of the bag, because he's... Well, sorry, Lionel.
Daniel, do you want to chuck the rubber ring over to Richard?
No, but what I'm saying is, when you speak to pros, and then even vehemently anti-doping pros, a lot of them single out Valverde as the rider they most admire. For the way that he races, for his professionalism, and that's not a euphemism, for his Sean Kelly-like consistency, where he is consistent from February to, you know, end of the year, throughout the year. So, I don't know, I mean, there's a lot to enjoy in watching Valverde, but of course there's this shadow.
Surely,
this
Daniel, is in looking at, if we had the data and we could see what sort of watts it took to win races pre-Alejandro Valverde's suspension and what it takes now, we would have some data that we could work out. You know, we could at least see how the performance is stacked up. You'd still have to take into account all sorts of things. I mean, you know, the technology's moved on such a lot, even in the last six or seven years. Well, it has, though, hasn't it? I mean, the data that could be collected now is, I would assume, better quality data than data that could have been collected in 2005. That's probably fair to say, isn't it? But
it is, Lionel. And, you know, you would have an even clearer picture if you knew, if you had data and you could match it with information about what a certain guy was taking or when they were taking it and so forth. But as I said, we don't have any of that because it's a unique period in professional cycling, certainly in the last 20 or 30 years, when we have really no information. I mean, people might contradict me here and point to the recent Bradley Wiggins saga. I mean, I don't really think that we have enough clarity on that to throw that into the argument, into the bargain just yet. But we don't really know what's going on a doping front. I mean, I wrote a piece for Pro Cycling Magazine recently where I spoke to various people involved in anti-doping, and they talked about, you know, the problems inherent with the biological passport, that the buffer zone being used for cycling is very broad, that when the biological passport was being conceived, the researchers realized that with cyclists, the variations are so large, so significant, that the buffer zone had to be quite big as compared to with athletics. That's why in professional cycling, you've had about a dozen biopassport cases as against about 80 since the inception of the biopassport in athletics. So, you know, the biopassport hasn't caught a lot of people. There haven't been an awful lot of positive tests in the very top echelon. So, and, you know, and also speaking to riders, you know, they don't really know what is going on, if anything is going on, or on any great scale. So, you know, when it comes to someone like Valverde, all we have two real yardsticks, which are his past performances, how they compare to his current performances, and, you know, things like times on climbs, which, as I said, I'm personally, and I know that some people are confident in drawing conclusions on the basis of those two yardsticks. I personally am not, and I would rather, and this is a personal feeling, I would rather falsely proclaim someone innocent than falsely proclaim someone guilty on the basis of those two criteria.
Better a guilty man walks free than an innocent man sent to prison, as I think Winston Churchill once said.
Just on the biological passport, though, Daniel, when it was conceived, the whole point really was to narrow the window of opportunity for people who were doping, you know, who wanted to dope, because it was an absolute wild west, wasn't it? Until the test to detect synthetic EPO came in, riders were able to take it with impunity. And then even after the test, once the test was ratified, it was still easier to evade detection, I would suggest. And certainly when the biological passport and the kind of the intelligence-based detection was brought in around about 2006, 2007, when Anne Gripper was the head of the UCI's anti-doping services department, it was about trying to make it much harder for, you know, this is a sort of colloquial term, but much harder for the sort of industrial levels of blood doping that were going on. And the biological passport has narrowed parameters, but that doesn't necessarily mean that people aren't operating within those parameters and aren't tripping the tripwire. So you're absolutely right. We don't really know what is going on. But we do know Alejandro Valverde's past. We know he served a 2-year suspension. We know he's come back and slotted into the peloton pretty much exactly where he was before. Now, whether that says more about Valverde or more about the peloton, very hard to say.
And Lionel, that he showed very little, if any, contrition.
Indeed. Anything else happened at the Tour of Catalonia, though, quickly? Surely some other things happened.
Well, I mentioned those two young riders. I thought their performances were worth mentioning. And Soler in particular, you know, as Valverde enters, we think, the autumn of his career, Marc Soler is being tipped as Spain's next big stage race talent. He looked very strong. I mean, he's a very gangly, long, tall rider, isn't he? Not the classic build for a stage racer, perhaps, but he's building on some pretty strong performances last year to look like a far more complete package this year, and he could be a very useful ally for Movistar come the summer.
And very lastly, Chris Froome's 30th place overall, somewhat incongruous 30th place.
Yeah, that was an odd one, similar to Formigal last year at the Vuelta, perhaps, where Sky were ambushed. I don't think that was quite the case this year. They just missed out on this move. I think Froome went into the race not expecting or even intending to be in contention overall. I think he was surprised to find himself there. I don't think there'll be any sense of panic. I think he probably got out of the race what he wanted from the race. I think we'll see a more competitive Chris Froome over the coming weeks, but I mean, this has been his approach the last couple of years. He's tended, you know, whereas in 2013 he was all guns blazing right from the start of the year, he's tended to come in a little bit, start the season a little bit steadier. Last year the reason for that was supposedly the Rio Olympics. He hasn't got that this year, of course, but you know, the way that he won the Tour last year suggested that he didn't need to be in winning form at Tour of Catalunya, because he wasn't last year either.
Hey, it's Lisa Brennauer, rider from Team Canyon SRAM Racing, and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. I ride because I really love to be on the bike, I love to be outside and like to discover some new places, but I also, of course, like to compete and race against others, and it really gives me a good feeling. I got into cycling because my brother started cycling and I enjoyed to see him racing and riding his bike, so I really wanted to do a bit what he does, and I loved it so much to be at his races and watch him, so I decided that this is what I was gonna do as well.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Yes, thank you very much indeed to Rafa, who sponsor the Cycling Podcast. Very grateful to them. I think they supplied you with some nice clothing for your Flanders adventures, Lionel.
I did.
You cut a dash in your pink over socks.
Yeah, as I said in the special episode, I don't think Belgium's ready quite for middle-aged men in pink over socks.
No, but you know, it's got to start. It's got to start somewhere. Let me mention before we go on and hear from Christian Prudhomme that the Rafa Monuments competition is rolling into the Tour of Flanders. Of course, they ran this for Milan-San Remo. A terrific prize for that, and the prize for this is also fantastic. You can win a Canyon bike, top of the range Canyon Endurance CFSL Disc 8.0. The perfect bike for taking on a cobbled classic of your own. Enter the competition. The competition, of course, is to guess the winning time. Guess the winning time. What will be the winning time at the Tour of Flanders? I'm going to ask you, Lionel and Daniel, for your suggestions in a moment. But you can enter up to midday on the day of the race. That's midday British summertime on the day of the race. There was a bit of confusion last time over the website address, which I may have read out slightly wrong, although I would argue that wasn't my fault. Anyway, the web address to enter the competition is www.rafa.cc/win, W-I-N, rafa.cc/win. And as I say, enter the competition. And if you enter, just by entering the competition, you get 20% off Rafa products. Stuff that you buy either online or in a Rafa clubhouse. So there you go. Just by entering the competition, 20% off. But you could win a bike. Lionel, what will be the winning time on Sunday?
I'm going to say 6 hours, 10 minutes, 37 seconds.
Daniel?
6 hours, 10 minutes, 38 seconds.
Okay, I'll say 6 hours, 10 minutes, and 36 seconds.
Well, 6 hours, 10 minutes, 37 seconds was Peter Sagan's winning time last year. So if that does happen again this year, then...
That'd be amazing.
It would be. That would be quite a coincidence.
Wow.
Well, anyway,
when I'm riding out, to your house on my top of the range Canyon bike, Lionel, I'll be grateful for the inspiration you gave me with my entry there. Listen, Daniel, you were where were you? You've been somewhere recently. You met Christian Prudhomme.
I was in Düsseldorf over the weekend. There was a little get together. Well, a few journalists were invited to Düsseldorf, where of course the Tour de France is going to start in July. There was a visit to the Lycée Français, the French school in Düsseldorf. Christian Prudhomme, Bernard Thévenet went to speak to the children there about the Tour de France that's coming. There was an event on the Saturday called Bonjour Le Tour, which was sort of a presentation 100 days, or it was actually 99 days before the Grand Départ itself, to tell the people of Düsseldorf about what's going to happen in July. You know, some music and various festivities there. There was also something called the Petit Départ, which Düsseldorf the city, has invented. It's come up with this concept of a race for school children all around the city. The heat started on Saturday, and the winning children are going to go through to a final and will eventually appear, I think, on the day of the Grand Départ itself. So various things going on to do with the Grand Départ in Düsseldorf. And it was a good chance, really. Well, I'd only been to Düsseldorf once before, but it was a good chance, really, to sort of get to know the place and get a feel for what sort of Grand Départ it's going to be in July.
Daniel, what's Düsseldorf like? And more importantly, what are the restaurants like?
Well, Lionel, Düsseldorf is a big city. I think it's the sixth or seventh biggest city in Germany. About 700,000 people live there. I think most importantly, from the point of view of the Tour de France, it's very, very close to the Dutch border. It's very, very close to the Belgian border. And it's also very close to other major German cities like Essen, like Cologne, like Dortmund. So I think there's going to be a fantastic turnout for the Tour de France. I mean, it was interesting. You really get the sense that in Germany, I mean, this is just also observing over the past few months, that the counter has been reset to zero as far as Germany and cycling is concerned. And the general public in Germany's knowledge of cycling. I mean, there were stands, sponsors' stands on Saturday in Düsseldorf, and trying to engage the public in various different ways. And there was a Skoda stand, and at one point I was walking past there, and you know, dozens of people, maybe 100 or so people, watching what was going on there. And the guy, the sort of PA, was talking about current German riders. And he actually asked the crowd to name a German rider, and they couldn't. They couldn't name a single rider, and this was maybe 100 people. Maybe they were just shy, but I got the sense that actually, you know, they'd never heard of Tony Martin, they'd never heard of Marcel Kittel, they'd never heard of André Greipel. And, you know, I say that the counter's been reset to zero because, of course, you know, Germany does have this unhappy recent history with professional cycling where everything went bust in 2006. And you know, they've had to really start from scratch again. But, you know, I felt the atmosphere, the mood was one of curiosity rather than cynicism or rather than hostility towards the Tour de France. And I think it'll be a good weekend. And as regards eating and drinking, Lionel, it's interesting, actually, that the kind of culture, eating and drinking culture there reminded me a bit of places in England. In Düsseldorf, you have this almost like a pub culture where people sort of stand in the street drinking what they call out beer, old beer, which is typical of Düsseldorf's kind of a dark beer, not the sort of beer that you get in the rest of Germany, in Bavaria, which is famous for beer, or Berlin, where I live, quite particular. But I'm sure you'll like it.
I'm sold. I can't wait to get there. Although it does sound like the Germans are going to be slightly disappointed when Jan Ullrich's not in the yellow jersey, but I'm sure they'll get over that.
Well, we'll discuss. We're going to actually discuss Jan Ullrich and his relationship with this Tour de France, the 2017 Tour de France, in forthcoming episode. I think of Kilometre Zero, I'm going to do a bit of a special on my weekend in Dusseldorf and the Grand Depart in due course.
I think you spoke to Christian Prudhomme while you were there, Daniel.
Well, I did, Richard. I spoke to Christian Prudhomme about various things. Of course, I spoke to him about the Grand Depart in Germany. Interesting, actually, just on that, Rich, Christian Prudhomme, I'm not sure how well known this was, but he did confirm to me that London was, well, it was signed, sealed and delivered. London was going to host the 2017 Grand Depart, and then they pulled out, and Dusseldorf was actually teed up for 2018, and London pulled out. Christian Prudhomme contacted the mayor in Dusseldorf, Thomas Geisel, and asked him whether they could move the Grand Depart forward a year, 2017, and Dusseldorf agreed. So that's why it's taking place this year. But yeah, I spoke to Christian Prudhomme about various issues. He's been observing the current affairs in the world of professional cycling very attentively over the last few months, as you can imagine, particularly been observing what's been happening with Team Sky and the whole furore around Bradley Wiggins, and also Velon's announcement that a new series of races is going to take place this year, the Hammer Series. We spoke about a few weeks ago, didn't we? It's a three-day race, a new format. Short races, two-hour races on three consecutive days, a sprint race, a climbing race, and a team time trial to finish things off. And you know, we know a bit about the dispute that's been going on, or the sort of cold war that's been going on over the past couple of years between Velon and ASO. So we probably didn't expect Christian Prudhomme to be too warm, too enthusiastic about the idea of the Hammer Series, particularly as the first Hammer race in Holland is going to take place on the same weekend as the opening weekend of the Dauphiné, which is an ASO race. Anyway, here's Christian Prudhomme talking first about Team Sky and then talking about his views on the Hammer Series.
I'm watching what's happening with Sky very closely. We organised the Tour of Yorkshire. I have a lot of friends in the UK, and I just know that an investigation is taking place, and they'll get right to the very bottom of this. I don't know what they're going to find, but I'm absolutely confident in the result of this investigation. I won't say much more than that. Looking beyond cycling, we're talking about a country in which democracy and transparency still mean something. I think two things about the Hammer Series. On one hand, I think trying to find new formats is a great idea, even if I also think the best format, with both historical roots and a future, is Strade Bianche. That's obvious. The second thing I think is that it's great to know there are suddenly no rules on organising races. To put on this three-day race, they've needed at least seven special exemptions, whereas we might ask for just two or three special exemptions over a whole Tour de France. And that's just for a slightly longer than usual neutralised zone in a big city, or, like 2 years ago, for a team time trial after 8 days. But anyway, all of that aside, there's a fundamental issue. Namely, that cycling history is built around individual champions. It's Coppi and Bartali, Anquetil, Merckx, it's Hinault. It's not a team. Cycling is an individual sport contested by teams, and that's what it'll always be. I'm absolutely certain. Nonetheless, like I said, we're absolutely thrilled there aren't really any rules anymore. Our technical director, Thierry Gouvenou, is jumping for joy, safe in the knowledge that we can do loads of things now. I imagine that Mauro Vegni, the Giro boss, is the same in Italy.
Well, Christian Prudhomme, pretty forthright there in his comments about the Hammer Series, Daniel.
Shots fired, as they say.
Shots fired. Yeah, how will your friend Graham Bartlett feel about that after your cosy cocktails with him in the Middle East recently?
Well, Graham Bartlett, who is the boss at Velon, isn't he? I actually contacted him today to ask him whether this was true. Christian Prudhomme said that Velon had applied, or the organisers of the Hammer Series had had to apply for seven special rule exemptions for their inaugural race. I actually asked
Graham Bollett, if that was true. He'd actually given my inquiry to one of his colleagues and they were going to get back to me. I haven't got an answer on that, but I will give an answer on that maybe next week's podcast. But yeah, it's interesting that, you know, that this tension between Velon and ASO is real. I personally don't really see the issue if Velon have had to apply for and obtained various special exemptions. I mean, the whole point of this Hammer series is that it's something new. It's a completely different twist. And I suppose it's to be expected that it doesn't really follow the letter of the current UCI rules.
And not all exemptions are the same, are they? I mean, Prudhomme's maybe, when you're talking about a Grand Tour and you're asking for extra long stages, or as he mentions, a team time trial so deep into the race, these are different sorts of exemptions to the sorts of exemptions that there may be in place for the Hammer series, which is just an innovative and new type of racing. Anyway, should we wrap things up for this week? Because we've gone on long enough. Okay, well, listen, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you very much. Enjoy the Tour of Flanders, Rich.
Thank you very much indeed again to our sponsors, Rafa and Science and Sport. Thank you to Jonathan Rowe and Nick Christian, who produced the newsletter, among other things. And thank you to this week's producer, Mariana DeForge.